There are times when what's happening in the world around you seems just too much, or too mundane. You want to go somewhere else, to be somewhere else, and your vacation plans are months and savings accounts away. But there are other worlds you can visit. A few years ago, one came flying into our offices in a padded mailer containing a book called The Name of the Wind. Its author, Patrick Rothfuss, had spent years creating a world so compelling just one visit wasn't enough. Now he's back with the long-awaited sequel, The Wise Man's Fear.
My name is Kvothe. My father once told me it meant to know. I have stolen princesses back from sleeping barrow kings. I've burned down the town of Treban. I was expelled from the university at a younger age than most people are allowed in. I tread paths by moonlight that others fear to speak of during day. I have talked to gods, loved women, and written songs that make the minstrels weep. You may have heard of me.
Pat, with this new book, With the Wise Man Fear, you have drawn thousands of us, again, into a world you introduced in The Name of the Wind. In order to do this, you've had to create another entire world.
Yeah. There are a bunch of different little subgenres of fantasy. One of the big breaks is in between, say, urban fantasy, which happens in this world, and what's called secondary world fantasy. That's like The Lord of the Rings, where it's happening in another place. Tolkien created Middle-earth, and then he told his stories in there.
And that's what you do. Tell me about the world.
Well, the world has been sort of a hobby that works in conjunction with my hobby of writing. You know, back before I was a published author, I built the world itself almost in the same way that somebody might work on a model train set. And kind of with the same amount of sometimes obsessive detail-orientedness. You know, you see the people and they work on the tiny trees and they set up the little tableaus. And that's what I've done with this world. Some people say, oh, it's kind of a medievalish world, because that's the standard in most secondary world fantasy. But it really isn't. Yes, it has horses. Yes, there's not a high level of obvious technology. But really, it's closer to a Renaissance Europe. But to call it a Renaissance Europe place is really to go in the wrong direction. I have tried kind of hard to make it its own place.
Well, one of the things that, of course, makes it different from Renaissance Europe is that there is magic here.
There is.
In Renaissance Europe, they thought there was.
Right.
But you didn't stop there.
Well, what is interesting, and one of the main parts of the book, is the main character wants to know the difference between the stories people tell and the truth about the world. And it's easy to forget about that in the modern day when everyone has a super phone in their pocket and access to Wikipedia. We live in a world of kind of false certainty, where people believe that there's a true answer to every question, and usually it's only about 30 seconds away. But if you go to a world before mass communication, the difference between a world where people think there is magic and a world where there is magic, it's a very fine line. You know, Newton was a proud alchemist. And he wasn't crazy because of that. He was a respected alchemist. And the same thing is kind of true in my world, with the exception that the alchemy people can do tends to occasionally pay off. And there are other types of magic which are very mechanistic, and they follow the rules of thermodynamics. There is chemistry. There is basic physics.
The law of sympathy is one of the most basic parts of magic. It states that the more similar two objects are, the greater the sympathetic link. The greater the link, the more easily they influence each other. He pulled out a piece of paper and jotted a couple of words on it. It's called the sympathetic binding of parallel motion. Practice. It was magic. There was no doubt about that. But I felt rather underwhelmed. I had been expecting, I don't know what I'd been expecting. It wasn't this. The rest of that day was spent experimenting with the simple sympathetic binding Abinthy had taught me. I learned that almost anything could be bound together. An iron drab and a silver talent. A stone and a piece of fruit. Two bricks. A clod of earth and one of the donkeys. After I understood this little piece of sympathy, Ben taught me others. A dozen sympathetic bindings. 100 little tricks for channeling power. Each of them was a different word in a vast vocabulary I was just beginning to speak.
You talk about magic in terms that people who live in our world understand. Sympathy, for instance, taking the heat of your body or of something else and transferring it.
Yeah, I've always thought of it as being, it's sort of a scientific magic. I was going to be a chemical engineer before I strayed from the path in college and ended up studying history and philosophy and psychology and English instead. And so that definitely shows itself in some of the more realistic, the more tangible types of magic. And then, of course, there are the other types of magic in the world, which are generally poo-pooed.
Give me an example.
There's a type of magic called naming. Tamerlane the Great knew the names of all things, and so all things obeyed him, and he could call fire and lightning. Hence the title of the first book, The Name of the Wind.
Master Elodin, I still don't understand about names. He looked sideways at me. The nature of names cannot be described, only experienced and understood. Why can't it be described? I asked. If you understand a thing, you can describe it. Can you describe all the things you understand? Of course. Elodin pointed down the street. What color is that boy's shirt? Blue. What do you mean by blue? Describe it. I struggled for a moment. So blue is a name? It is a word. Words are pale shadows of forgotten names. Words can light fires in the mind of men. Words can wring tears from the hardest hearts. There are 7 words that will make a person love you. But a word is nothing but a painting of a fire. A name is the fire itself. My head was swimming by this point. I still don't understand.
Part of the reason I wrote these books, I think Peter S. Beagle once said that he wrote the book that he wished he could read. And when I heard him say that, I went, oh, that's what I've been doing for 10 years. I didn't realize it. But all I knew is that I'd read a fantasy novel or two a day for most of my adult life, all through high school, all through college. And eventually I started to get a little bored. You know, when you're 14, you love everything. It's very easy. But, you know, after a couple years of college and I've read Shakespeare and I've read Chaucer and I've read medieval drama and all the Harlem poets, and then I go back to the fantasy. I'm like, ugh, another goblin army, another fairy, another dwarf with an axe. And so I wanted to tell a different sort of fantasy story that didn't fall into the same pattern. But at the same time, I didn't want to entirely abandon the sort of story that I grew up reading and I always loved very much growing up.
But when you're creating these worlds, don't you have to refer to known entities, do research, find things that will help you to create the topography, people the place? Are these not based on cultures you know?
Oh, to some extent. I mean, I went to college for 9 years. I was an undergrad for 9 years. I'm the poster child for misspent youth. You know, I took anthropology classes and history classes and philosophy and religious studies until they forced me to graduate, which I did very unwillingly. The plus side now is that I don't necessarily need to go, you know, boy, I wonder what feudal Japan was like. I've studied that a little bit. And so I kind of carry around a lot of eclectic knowledge in my head all the time.
Do you see it as kind of a way of supplying something that's missing from our world?
I don't know about missing. You know, you can live in Stevens Point, where I live now, you can live there your whole life and never really be missing anything. You have food and shelter. You have a Mexican restaurant. You have a library. You have cable television. But, you know, travel is broadening. And the travel I always did growing up was always in books. It grants you the joy of experience without the burden of experience. And fantasy does something that is in some ways even better. It gives you the opportunity to experience a world or ideas or cultures which are truly alien. I think it was Dickens that said, after reading The Arabian Nights, he said, "My mind has been now habituated to the vast." And that's what I think fantasy can do for us. It gives us an opportunity to experience vast things, to kind of be stretched in our experience beyond anything we could experience in this world. I don't think it's a coincidence that so many scientists, engineers, creative physicists, these people read fantasy. And I don't think they read fantasy because they like science. I think they've read fantasy at an early age, and it has taught them to think in terms of possibility and what if. And those sorts of minds are capable of solving problems in a much better way than a mind that has really only known, you know, 5 streets in a small town in central Wisconsin.
Sunlight poured into the waystone. It was a cool, fresh light, fitted for beginnings. The light fell across Chronicler's face and touched a beginning there, a blank page waiting the first words of a story. Chronicler dipped his pen and Kvothe looked down at his folded hands for as long as it takes to draw 3 deep breaths. Then he began to speak.
Patrick Rothfuss is the author of The Name of the Wind. The sequel, called The Wise Man's Fear, debuted this year at number 1 on the New York Times bestseller list.